attention. This is your captain speaking. The forecast looks clear for today. We should have a smooth ride to 400. We should have a smooth ride to 400. Our flight attendants will be around shortly with headphones for those who need them. So sit back and enjoy the ride.
Monday Night Raw. We have Grumpy Cat. Now, Grumpy Cat was the guest star, the guest celebrity on this show. Michael Cole referred to Grumpy Cat as Grumpy the Cat at one point. Yeah, and you're Shitty the Announcer. They give us the dreaded fuck finish. Lame, lame, lame. You want to do the finish where the guy gets DQ'd for kicking ass? How about not doing it with your Intercontinental Champion? How about that? Some of these matches will go 10, 12, 15 minutes only to get a fuck finish or no finish at all in the end. If WWE insists on fucking the fans over so many times, the least they can do is buy us dinner first. Jeff Hardy is being beaten down with a metal object, and instead of just, you know, screaming like Jeff Hardy normally would to sell the fact that, shit, that hurts, he's doing his weird Willow screams. I mean, you want to see a Willow impression? Here's my Willow impression. Willow is being beaten down by the metal object because Willow sucks! We had the contract signing for the match between Seth Rollins and John Cena. Rollins name-dropped Bob Dylan, who was born in Minnesota, said, "The times, they are a-changing." The crowd did not react at all. I guess if Rollins would have mentioned Demi Lovato, it would have gotten a reaction. Or Meek Mill. What the fuck is a Meek Mill anyway? Can somebody answer that for me? Oh, hey, I'm gonna name myself after a quiet place that makes shit. Fuck. Go listen to some real music, please. And I don't want to hear, oh, it was all children in the crowd. Kids don't know who Bob Dylan is. Really, I didn't know that kids drove themselves to the arena. In New York, you get your learner's permit at 16. In Minnesota, I guess the age is 6. Then they have a hat. The hat itself is actually nice. It looks like a nice hat. What's wrong with this is it's a beard baseball hat. The entire brim of the hat is a hairy beard. Who the fuck would wear this? Backstage, Eric Rowan played with Renee Young's hair and said, "Pretty. Ooh, you know, me like caveman. You pretty. Me break up from Wyatt family. Me get no push anymore. Me get released. Me sign with TNA." That's usually the pattern here. Whatever happened to real men on this show? Can you imagine, in any other era of WWE, dressing down your top star the way that Stephanie McMahon did to John Cena on Monday night? They've done this with Cena, they've done this with Bryan, they've done it with Dolph, they've done it with Ryback, they did it with Rollins. Remember the infamous episode where Big Show was on his knees in the middle of the ring crying for his job? Tears are just streaming down this guy's face. This guy's 7 feet tall, 450 pounds, he's in the ring crying. He's a giant. Yeah, he's a giant pussy.
We are here with the new married couple.
Now we're tag team partners for life.
John and Marty said the same thing once upon a time.
Oh, I knew he was going to do that.
What a despicable act that was.
No. Oh, my God. Let me school you, son. Kathy Lee. I had to sit in the stands and watch Granny break a wine bottle over another woman's ass. What a classy lady. And I loved how she went for the cheap pop by pleading with everybody, "My mother was born in Brooklyn." As if that's supposed to impress all of us. Guess what? It didn't. They got exactly the reaction they deserved. There's a lot of dumb shit this woman has said over the years that should have earned her a lifetime ban from television. She's got no business being on TV. Why is she employed? Why does she have a job? The picture of class, Kathy Lee Gifford.
Brock Lesnar, I think his name is.
Do you know anything about him?
Yeah, I mean, I hear. Well, actually, I went to Raw about 2 months ago, and they have these matches before the events go to matches. Air. And I saw him come out. This guy's a monster, first of all.
Really?
Yeah, he's a monster.
Welcome to McMahon's Pastry Palace.
I'll have a piece of the Brian fudge cake, please.
I've got something even better. How would you like to try the Samoan caramel twist?
No, thanks. I think I'm going to stick with the Brian fudge cake.
Now look here, you lazy millennial son of a bitch. You're gonna like this damn Samoan cake because I know what's good for you, damn it.
Screw you. I don't want any of your Samoan cake. In fact, I hate Samoan cake. I'd rather eat dog shit.
Get out of my shop.
Don't tell me what to do.
Get the hell out of my shop.
The moral of the story, kids, is that it's not the cake's fault that the chef is an asshole.
I heard that.
So Triple H went through this speech. WWE has been his life for 2 decades now. And others have come and gone. And all of that was nearly taken away by one guy, and that guy is Sting. And Triple H said, I helped crush WCW. I'm sorry. I can't say that with a straight face. I'm sorry. He really was not missed. Maybe by the kids. But fuck the kids. I don't care about the kids. I don't have any kids. This is the sound off. There's a reason the word wrestling is not anywhere in the title of the show. I can pretty much sound off on anything. Bill Cosby. Multiple accusations from multiple women. When you have 10 different women, at least, whose stories all seem to follow the same pattern, you can't bury your head in the Jell-O pudding and ignore it. Here's a guy who spent the last however many years yelling at black kids to pull up their pants, shouting it as loud as he could in front of whatever TV camera they put in front of his face. And now, when it comes to questions about dropping his own pants, all of a sudden, he's got nothing to say. And to me, that says it all. We get another John Cena vs. Randy Orton match, so help me God, I will put a voodoo curse on everybody in that company. And if you think I'm joking, just try me. I have my little voodoo doll I bought when I was in New Orleans for WrestleMania. I'm looking at it right now across the room. It's right over there. It's got a white pin for good luck and a black pin for evil. Don't make me go black on your ass. Now, are you ready for this? Hold on to your socks, and if you don't have any, put some on and hold on to them, because you're not going to believe this.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm set. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
For the 400th time, welcome to the Solid Monster Sounds Off. This is indeed episode 400. Here on Sunday, September 13, 2015, I am the Solid Monster. My thanks to Missionary from Wrestling Soup and to Noah Mark for all of his hard work in putting together that great intro that you heard there. And thank you guys for 400 episodes. I know it sounds kind of cliche. I know we have a lot of people still listening to this show who are listening back in the SE Scoops days, who are listening back from episode number one, and you're still with me today. I don't know why, but you are, and I can't thank you enough for that. And speaking of the very first episode, this is a great, perfect time to bring this up. Episode number 10 of The Sound Off actually went up on our YouTube channel this past week. I started something a while back where I said I was going to be uploading classic episodes of the podcast that are not online anymore. First 42 episodes or so, save for maybe one or two that are uploaded on Podbean. Most of the first 42 cannot be found online. They've kind of been lost. I call them the lost episodes in a way. And so the first 10 are now on our YouTube channel, including the very first two episodes. They're kind of merged together in one video on our channel, since episode number one is only about 7 minutes long, so I combined the two of them. So if you wanted to listen to the first 10 episodes of the podcast from yesteryear, 2007, into the early part of 2008, they are up on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thesolemonster. Go back and check those out. And sporadically here and there, I'll upload additional episodes, 11 and 12 and 13, and then you can kind of follow along as we get through the year 2008 and some of the more interesting things that took place. I just wanted to mention that up front here, and we've come a long way from then. And so let's just get into it now. People have asked me, what are you doing for episode 400? Are you going to do anything special? I'm going to do what I do every single week, which is talk about Raw and talk about NXT and talk about whatever the hell I want to talk about. And I figure what I would do on this show is I would kind of expand the mailbag a little bit more, because I figured that would be the best thing for me to do, for you guys, is to answer as many of your questions as I possibly can. So I think we have a much more expanded mailbag later in the show, and that'll allow us to get into a whole bunch of interesting topics this week. But first, as we do with every episode, I've got to give some love to Audible And our Audible URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. A lot of you guys have been using it to sign up for the free 30-day trial of the Audible service that they are providing to listeners of this podcast. People still cashing in their free audiobook, which you get when you sign up. And even if you decide that, you know, Audible's not for you and you decide to cancel out of the trial in those first 30 days, as you are all well aware, you get to keep your one free audiobook. A lot of people still cashing in on that Daniel Bryan book and saying great things about it. Some people cashing in on non-wrestling books. There's 180,000 different ones to choose from, so whether it's the Bryan book or something completely different, yeah, it's yours to keep. So use our URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. That could be your little 400 gift to the podcast there, because every time you use our URL, it helps us out. So audibletrial.com/solemonster is the link to use. And don't forget, we have our shirts up as well on prowrestlingtees.com/solemonstersoundsoff. We have up to a size 5XL on all of our shirts, which ship all over the world. And last but not least here, before we move on, I would be remiss if I did not do the PayPal shout-outs here. We had a lot of people who donated to the show this week, and I want to show them some love here on the 400th episode. You can make a PayPal donation if you want to. On thesolemonster.com, the PayPal box is on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname like these people. Playboy Tiago Lerero, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, True Grit Tim Goggin, Deadpool James Herrera, Doomsday Donde Page, Judge and Jury Justin Girardi, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Fast Blast Tim Banks, Bobby the Wizard Waldrop, Dwayne Rainmaker Reebling, Keith the Conqueror Krajnik, Brian Hitman Hurst, Jonathan Killjoy Keen, the Dallas Dragon, Derek Jackson, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, who is on Instagram, in case you want to check out some of his photos. He's got some pretty cool video game related photos up there, so I'd head on over to Wright0007, that's WRIGHT0007. The Bogota Big Shot, Fernando Leon, who turned 30 this past week. Happy birthday, buddy. Thank you for all of your support. And by the way, happy birthday to Brittany and Mrs. Times. That comes from Dylan. So thank you to everybody who made a donation to the show this week. You guys keep this thing going, and I really do appreciate all of the support. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Baltimore, Maryland. Not a good Labor Day for WWE. The ratings usually down a bit for the holiday, but not down by this much. 3.3 million viewers last Monday, which is down over 500,000 viewers from the week before. They dropped 500,000 viewers just in hour three alone, let alone overall from what they were the week before. You can blame whatever college football game that was on. I don't even know what the game was. Ohio? Iowa? I'm just guessing now. I don't know. I don't care. But you can blame it on whatever game you want to. And I'm sure it did hurt a little bit, because those games usually do pretty big ratings. But this was the lowest rating since Christmas Eve 3 years ago. And if you take away Christmas and you take away July 4th and all the really big holidays that they're typically down in and TV is typically down in, it was the lowest number since 1997. Think about that. 1997, almost 20 years ago. And it was the lowest number since then. This is not just a football problem, although they have a very big football problem coming up this week. But this is not just a football problem. So, you know, you kind of ask yourself, well, why should we care? Who gives a shit about the ratings? Why do we care? What does this mean? Well, one reason you should care is because even though the ratings don't mean what they did, let's say, 16 years ago when they were fighting a war head-to-head against WCW, they still live and die by those ratings. You know, for rightly or wrongly, they live and die by those numbers. And also because for weeks now, I have found the show to be largely boring. I think it's raw as snore for the most part. And apparently I'm not the only one who feels this way. And the hope is that when the numbers fall the way that they have, that WWE will realize that something has to change and they'll actually make some changes to improve the show. That's the hope anyway. And they better make some kind of change here, because if they thought last week was bad, you know, Monday Night Football is back this week, which means we may not have bottomed out just yet. You know, how low can they go? I don't think WWE wants to find out. So they're going to have to do something. Randy Orton versus Sheamus is not the answer. I looked into it because I was curious. So when the numbers came out and a lot of the wrestling sites reported on it, I was more curious in what each hour of the show did. So I read up on it, and the big drop-off was from hour 2 to hour 3. That was the big drop-off. And sure enough, guess what match was the bridge from hour 2 to hour 3? Fucking Randy Orton versus Sheamus. It started right before the top of the hour. 15 minutes that match went. We're not quite at Orton versus Cena levels yet with these two guys, but we're getting there. When they announced that match on this show, I couldn't believe it. I was just like, are you kidding me? And then you wonder how they could do such a horrible number. So the story of the show was Sting playing mind games with Seth freaking Rollins and holding Rollins' statue hostage, daring him to come get it. Seth freaking Rollins was out for a promo to open the show. That's JBL's new favorite thing, by the way, Seth freaking Rollins. You know how I feel about these Rollins promos, never ending, crowd chanted boring. Opening segment, very first thing on the show, and you have the crowd chanting boring. Rollins improvised a nice little comeback to it. I don't remember what he said, but it masks a bigger problem, which is that they always put him out there for way too long. He's overexposed. He's overexposed as it is, but the promos, they're just painful to sit through. Because he always says the same thing. And what takes this guy 15 minutes to say, because they have, they got 3 hours to kill, so they put him out there and they say, all right, this is how long you have, and stretch it out. So what takes this guy 15 minutes to say can be said in 5. You know who else's promos used to be like that every single week? Triple H, Sting's favorite wrestler. The man that Rollins is probably going to be wrestling in a few months. That's something to look forward to. Dueling promos between Triple H and Seth Rollins. I can't wait. Sheamus came out to confront Rollins and teased cashing in his money in the bank to win the title and Night of Champions. Because that's exactly what we need to drum up interest in this show and boost the numbers. Sheamus as WWE champion. Backstage, Triple H not so subtly teasing heat with Rollins for Rollins' comments about him last week, told Seth that he would be wrestling twice on this show as a warm-up for Night of Champions. He put him in a champion versus champion match against Ryback in a 6-man tag teaming with New Day against John Cena and the Primetime Players. The Boss, Sasha Banks, pinned Paige with a distraction roll-up, 9 minutes and 52 seconds. Naomi provided said distraction. It's been a while since we've had one of those on Raw. That was number 15 on the year, courtesy of distractionrollup.com, which continues to be updated, so bookmark it and check back often. I saw this as more fuel for a potential Paige heel turn. Her partners were out there in her corner again, but did nothing to help her. I thought this was good. Nothing close to what these two women are capable of. It did get a This Is Awesome chant near the very end, but that, it almost felt like it was just starting to get going and it could have benefited from another 5 minutes. Like, they started the This Is Awesome chant and the match ended. Like, immediately, it just ended. And I feel like we're so early in this revolution they love to talk about. This is the time that you need to be having a takeover-esque, kick-ass women's match to get people to buy into the fact that these matches are different than what you've come to expect for the last 5 or 10 years out of the divas on this show. So far, the only thing different about the matches from, let's say, 6 months ago are the faces, not the matches themselves. So we're heading into Raw this week. They're doing the championship match early between Charlotte and Nikki, and they're playing up the fact that Nikki is going to break AJ Lee's record and become the longest reigning divas champion of all time. Here's my prediction for the match. Here's what I predict will happen. Charlotte's in control. She has Nikki beat. There's brawling going on outside the ring with all the other team members who are out there in each of their respective corners. Somehow, Paige ends up getting Charlotte disqualified. Okay, seemingly by accident, even if it really isn't. But she gets Charlotte disqualified. Nikki breaks the record, and they've now planted the seed for the breakup of Team PCB. The Authority makes a triple threat match for the title at Night of Champions, because remember, all the titles have to be defended. So they make a triple threat match for the pay-per-view with Nikki defending against Charlotte and against Paige. And that can be where they do the turn with Paige going heel. She comes out of that feuding with Charlotte and Becky. And meanwhile, Nikki Bella gets to move on to feud with Sasha Banks for the championship. And Sasha then wins the title. You move the Bellas aside. Focus on Paige, Charlotte, Becky, each wrestling Sasha over the next several months for the championship, and maybe even bring back Natty so she can get some shine from all this. And because I think a Sasha versus Natty feud for the championship could be a lot of fun. People like Natalya. They can sympathize with her, they can sympathize with her feeling left out of the mix and wanting to get the title back and all the stuff that's happened with TJ. She's gone through some tough times recently. It's a comeback story. That's really what it is. It's a comeback story for her. You build a comeback around her trying to regain the championship. And Sasha is just such a great bitch. I mean, what a great bully she was to Bayley on NXT. I just think there's a great story there to be told with women that the fans actually respect and would not shit all over. So, let me know what you think about that. I mean, saying that out loud now, because I was thinking about it and I said, I like this idea. Now that I say it out loud, it sounds like complete fantasy booking and exactly not what WWE would do. But I do think Nikki breaks the record. They do a three-way at the pay-per-view, and that's where we get the PCB breakup. So that's my prediction. Dean Ambrose and Roman Reigns squashed the Ascension in 3 minutes, just 4 days after the Ascension formed a new group with Stardust on SmackDown, Cosmic Wasteland. Which at least the announcers mentioned. They did briefly mention that on commentary, but they then get squashed on the very next show like nobodies. So, some group they turned out to be. Dead before it even begins. Rollins and Ryback non-title. Yet another example of a champion versus champion match being thrown together on TV like no big deal. Just like they did with Nikki and Sasha. I thought it was pretty good. Pretty good stuff until the finish. Sting popped up on the Titantron again, which distracted Rollins and allowed Ryback to roll him up for the pin. The second distraction roll-up of the night. Number 16 on the year. And we were doing so well. We hadn't had one in weeks and weeks and weeks. And just like that, we have two on one show. Now, if distraction roll-ups were like Jack Daniels, it would be appropriate to say that WWE fell off the wagon this week and needs to check itself back into rehab. And like most addicts, I'm sure WWE will deny it even has a problem and will continue with the roll-ups until they self-destruct. By the way, for those keeping score, the Intercontinental Champion pinned the WWE Champion. I know on SmackDown they rematched the two of them. They had a lumberjack match. Rollins got his win back. But still, you would think with this win, that would earn Ryback a championship match. Will Ryback get his championship match? Of course he won't. Because, as Nikki Bella once said, wins and losses, who cares? We got a backstage segment with Edge and Christian, the Dudley Boys and the New Day, where Xavier Woods played the trombone, Christian played a kazoo, and Big E tried to eat the kazoo. So this was pretty much the best thing on the entire show. Hands down. I should have just turned it off after this because there was no topping this segment. The Ziggler-Rusev Hot Summer Cold Fish Lana storyline hit the skids this week when Lana broke her wrist training in the ring before a house show. She had surgery, is not expected back, at least not doing anything physical, for up to 4 months. And that sucks, because they were setting up for a mixed tag match at Night of Champions, and now, instead, we're getting yet another Rusev-Dolph singles match. Because I don't think they've quite figured out what they're going to do now. So they had to come up with something new on this show as well, and that was Summer Rae coming out to beg for forgiveness from Rusev over her accidentally seeing Dolph Ziggler naked the week before when he came out of the shower. They aired this stupid video, voiced over by this TMZ-sounding buffoon, which made the whole thing even hokier than it already is. Wasn't enough to air this thing once. They actually aired it a second time. This almost irritated me as much as the Hulu guy. Remember the Hulu guy? I couldn't watch Raw, so I almost quit my job at Walmart, yeah. I'm not a wrestling fan. I'm a WWE fan, absolutely. Remember that guy? I still get douche chills just thinking about that. So, Hot Summer called out Rusev, started to cry. The crowd chanted boring again. Rusev told Summer, "You betrayed me." To what, the Mets? "We don't need you. We have Cespedes." But he forgave her. He cut a promo on Lana. Ziggler came out, cut a promo on Rusev, and then super kicked him. And that was it. Rusev is seriously the only thing about this storyline that makes it worth watching. He's even better on Twitter. He posted something the other day like, "I forgive Lana and Summer. They are women." See, there's a guy who gets it. Randy Orton was shown conversing with Ambrose and Reigns backstage, presumably about being the third man at Night of Champions. We then had the Orton versus Sheamus match that died a death in the ratings and in the arena. Orton won clean with the RKO, continuing the streak of bad luck for those who carry the Money in the Bank briefcase. After the match, the lights went out, and when they came back on, Orton was surrounded by the Wyatt family. And they beat him up, left him laying, I guess because they saw him conversing with the Shield backstage, and they were trying to send a message. I was kind of stunned by how many of you thought Orton would end up being the third man because of this, you know, just so he can get his revenge on the Wyatts. I never, not one time, thought Randy Orton was going to be the third man. The moment they even showed him talking to Reigns and Ambrose backstage, I thought it was a red herring. And then the stuff they did on SmackDown where they beat up Jimmy Uso, it's kind of a pattern of the Wyatts beating up people who they think might accept the invitation to team with Reigns and Ambrose, and then in the end it'll turn out to be somebody that, you know, we don't see coming. Maybe it's Eric Rowan, which I think would be a fucking mistake, and not to mention a huge disappointment. But whoever it turns out to be, it's not going to be Randy Orton. And now I see the report saying that the angle was actually done to write Orton out of TV for a while because he's taking more time off. So he ain't the third guy. I don't know who it is, but it's not him. I'm still pitching for it to be Cesaro, although after what they did with him on this show, that doesn't look too likely. And let's just get into the Cesaro stuff now, since I mentioned his name. They had a match on this show between Cesaro and The Miz. And it consisted of mostly Miz beating the hell out of Cesaro, and Cesaro selling his ribs, which in storyline had been injured in the match with Kevin Owens the week before. So he's selling and selling and selling, and I'm sitting there thinking, and I even tweeted this before it happened. I said, I hope Cesaro doesn't need Big Show to beat The Miz. How foolish of me. I at least thought Cesaro was going to get a win, no matter how cheap it may have been. I thought he was actually going to win the match. Couldn't even do that. But I said, I hope Cesaro doesn't need Big Show to win the match for him. You know, he needs a dominant win on his own to get back on track. He's been doing a lot of losing. In fact, I can't remember before this week the last big match that Cesaro won. He's had a lot of impressive matches, even the matches with John Cena. He didn't win those. The matches with Kevin Owens, he didn't win those. So he needs to get back on track. So I say this, and then who walks out but the fucking Big Show? And of course, Cesaro is an afterthought. Big Show wants Miz, because Miz cost Big Show the Intercontinental title in that match with Ryback the week before. Miz runs away, just runs right out of the building. Big Show's chasing him around the ring. Big Show is on a foot chase outside the ring. Miz bails. The referee calls for the bell. It's a double countout, or as I like to call it, a waste of our time. So Big Show is all pissed off and angry. He turns around to go walk to the back, and as he's walking, as he's about to make his way up the aisleway, Cesaro is there, just getting back to his feet, and Big Show just hauls off and punches him right in the face and knocks him out. Why? Because fuck you. That's why. No good reason. Just because he felt like it. And he walked off. So, not only did Cesaro not get the win against Miz, of all people, he can't even beat The Miz. I think he may have beaten him on SmackDown, but nobody watches SmackDown. SmackDown did its lowest rating, I think, ever, the week before last. Nobody gives a shit about SmackDown. I've said this before. They're going to move SmackDown to USA in January. They're going to give it a big main event that first week, maybe even the first 2 weeks. They'll make a big deal about it, and then it'll be forgotten. It'll be right back to where it is. They did this in January when they moved nights. They moved SmackDown back to Thursday. They had Daniel Bryan and Kane in a casket match on SmackDown. And after that, I couldn't tell you anything special that happened. I actually thought that was a pretty good casket match, all things considered. I mean, it was no Grave Consequences in Lucha Underground, but, you know, this is the pattern. When Main Event became a thing, when they debuted Main Event, remember that? Do you remember what the very first Main Event was on Main Event? It was CM Punk as WWE Champion. Oh, this is perfect. This is actually perfect that I'm even bringing this up, because I'm pretty sure it was Champion against Champion. I think Sheamus was the World Heavyweight Champion at the time, and they put them together in a title, not title for title, but it was champ versus champ. Another champion versus champion match. At least you can make the argument that they tried to make it a big deal. It was a brand new show, but still. They throw around these champ versus champ matches like fucking Pez on TV like they're nothing. But the point is, they tried to make it a big deal that first week, and maybe the first few weeks, and look at Main Event now. Main Event is exactly where you would have expected it to end up. And trust me, no matter how big they try to build up SmackDown in January, it too will end up where it is right now, which is in the doldrums, and nobody cares. So I don't care what they did with Cesaro and Miz on SmackDown. You know, Raw is their baby. Raw is their A-show. Cesaro could go on a fucking undefeated streak on SmackDown. If nobody knows about it, what does it really mean? So I looked at this, and I said to myself, and this is the genesis of the column I did. I did a new column this week on TJRWrestling.net. If you didn't see it, go over there. It's back in the archives. And the title is basically, Please Don't Drop the Ball on Cesaro Again. And I made the case for what happened to him last year and a lot of the mistakes that are being repeated, or I am afraid are going to be repeated this year by WWE. Until I sat down to write the column from start to finish, I had forgotten certain things. So I knew, you know, that the WrestleMania Battle Royal last year, that big moment. I mean, I was there, but even when I watch it back on TV and they zoom out after Cesaro body slam Big Show out of the Andre Battle Royal, and they zoom out and you get this wide shot of people just going nuts for this guy who had been nothing more than a mid-card tag team guy for months. I mean, him and Swagger were finally really building a chemistry together as the Real Americans, and then they broke him up. But there was no reason for people to care about Cesaro, but they were going nuts for the guy. You know, and you couldn't sit there and say, well, it's in front of an NXT smart crowd, you know, 500 people, of course they're going nuts. You had fucking 70,000, 80,000 people in that place going nuts for this guy. And then the next night they put Heyman with him, and it really looked like they had big plans for this guy. And it was exciting. But I said at the same time, it was also a little confusing because the people were on their own. This is not something WWE tried to do. On their own, they started to get behind Cesaro as, you know, a babyface. They didn't want him to be a heel anymore. They wanted to cheer for the guy. They wanted to root for the guy. And that was a big moment, a big turning point for him at WrestleMania. But then the next night, they put him with Heyman, who was a heel manager. You know, people were booing Heyman out of the building because every week now he would come out and talk about ending the streak. And that was taboo. People didn't want to hear about that. That was the one surefire way to get booed. You talk about The Undertaker losing at WrestleMania. So why put Cesaro with him? But, you know, I kind of overlooked it because I thought, man, this is a fucking great pairing. And if they're putting Heyman with him, they must have big plans. And I foolishly thought, and again, maybe this is like the diva stuff I talked about before. Maybe this wasn't so much a prediction as much as it was me hoping that this is what they would do. And of course they didn't. But I thought, okay, the end game here maybe is months down the road, they start building and building and teasing dissension in the ranks. Because Heyman is giving love to Brock Lesnar. He's giving him a verbal blowjob on the microphone every single week. And he's talking about conquering the streak. And he doesn't say a word about Cesaro. And maybe one day Cesaro just stands up for himself and says, hey, you know, I'm here too. And what it ends up in is Cesaro wanting to challenge Lesnar. You know, his fellow stablemate for the championship. And that would be a great way. It does a couple of things, right? It breaks Cesaro up from Heyman when it makes sense to. You know, eventually, they join, and eventually there's always going to be a breakup. But in doing the breakup, you're making Cesaro even stronger because he's standing up for himself. The people want to see him go after Brock. Brock was this menacing monster heel at the time. I mean, the fans ended up turning him babyface too, but there was a great story, I think, there to be told. And even at the time when I pitched the idea of doing a championship match at the Royal Rumble this year, now, they ended up doing that great triple threat match with Lesnar and Cena and Rollins. That was a great match. But my idea was to do Cesaro and Lesnar for the championship because, number one, it's a match we've never seen before. And I, like a lot of you, am dying to see Brock get in there with people, like good people, that he's never wrestled before. You know, get the guy some fresh matches. Even a guy like Randy Orton. And a lot of you pointed out to me, I made the mistake once of saying, oh, they never had a match on TV. And I guess they did once on SmackDown after Orton first debuted. Who remembers that? You know what I mean? And Orton was an infant. You know, he was a wrestling infant back then. Randy Orton of today is a lot different than the Randy Orton of 2002. To me, that would be a fresh match. You know, there's a lot of those that you can do. And the thing I love about the possibility of Cesaro being an opponent is the guy is a freak of nature. You know, he's not just another guy. Cesaro can do things with Brock in there that I think would be very impressive. You know, the feats of strength he's able to do. I mean, imagine Cesaro, I don't know if he'd be successful, but imagine him trying a, you know, standing delayed vertical suplex on Brock Lesnar. Fucking sweat dripping down, you know. I mean, what a great visual that would be. And it would get the people behind Cesaro even more because when he loses, yeah, I wouldn't have him beat Brock at the Rumble. He would lose, but, you know, even in defeat, he's gained a measure of respect, and people now look at him as somebody who can hang with the top guys. And there's no harm in doing that match at a show like the Royal Rumble because people aren't subscribing to the network or buying the pay-per-view, you know, buying the Rumble necessarily for the undercard. They're buying it for the Rumble match. The Royal Rumble pay-per-view is all about the Royal Rumble match. It almost doesn't even matter what championship match you do on the undercard. I mean, fuck, they did a title match one year with Brock Lesnar and Bob Holly. So I don't see the problem in saying, you know what, let's give this Cesaro guy a chance. We'll put him in the title match against Brock on the undercard. And they go out there, and they have a great match. And Cesaro, he looks good in defeat. And now you've got another guy that you can plug into main events as, you know, one of the top babyfaces on the babyface side. Maybe he's the number three babyface or something. I don't know. He's not going to replace Cena. But look at what they did with him and Heyman. Look at the alternative, even if you don't like that idea. Are you honestly going to tell me that what they did with this guy last year was better than what I just suggested? You're brain dead. If you honestly believe that, you're brain dead. They did nothing with this guy. He went on a losing streak at one point. And then one day, he shows up on Raw, and him and Heyman, they have a very amicable breakup. I'm going to go my separate ways, Paul. And that was it. There was no storyline, fallout from it, nothing. And after that, it was all downhill from there. Like I said, he went on a losing streak. He challenged for the IC title. He didn't win it. He challenged for the US title. He didn't win it. I think there was some kind of controversy. He made a comment or something in an interview that may have gotten him some heat. And he had this series of matches in the fall with Dolph Ziggler. He lost every single one of those matches. I think it might have been for the IC title. And then he just kind of lucked into this combination with Tyson Kidd, two guys who they weren't doing anything with. They weren't doing jack shit with either one of them, but both very talented. And they just formed this incredible chemistry and became a very entertaining tag team. And the people took to them. I mean, Kidd and Cesaro became a great act. And they won the tag team titles. And they were going down a good road. And then Tyson got hurt. And that was kind of the basis of the whole column that I wrote. Sometimes you got to take a negative and turn it into a positive. It sucks what happened to Tyson Kidd. I mean, this was not just any old injury. The guy could have fucking died. And I don't know if he's ever going to be able to come back or not. You know, you read conflicting things. People, you know, then Bret Hart does an interview and Bruce Hart does an interview and you don't know what to believe. I know it's a pretty major injury. I know we're not going to see him back in the ring for at least another year, if ever. So what happens to Cesaro? Now, the one good thing I could say is it would have been very easy for WWE to let this guy just kind of fall back into the background and do matches on Superstars every single week and SmackDown here and there. And that's it. You know, he could become the next Adam Rose or Fandango or Jack Swagger, or put him back with Jack Swagger and go back to that act. But they've given him some TV time. He's had some pretty damn good matches on Raw. They gave him and John Cena 30 minutes back in July to wrestle for the U.S. title. All of that is great. And I thought he had a great accounting for himself. He took the opportunity. He ran with it. You know, it wasn't through any fault of his own that he finds himself kind of right back to where he was now. I think he did everything expected of him that you could possibly ask him to do. And people showing up to the buildings now with the Cesaro section signs, and they do mention them on TV. So it's not like they've given up on him and they've just, you know, like I said, thrown him into the background and this guy's not worthy of being on TV. But I feel like they're making the same mistake again. The guy built up some momentum. Why would you do anything to squander that? You know, it was building and building and building, and the people were kind of getting into him more and more. You've got to feed off that. You can't just say, all right, well, now we're going to have him lose the next five matches in a row, and we'll have the Big Show knock him out. I'm not even sure that the plan is for him and Big Show to feud. I said in the article, I hope it is. I don't think it's a great idea. I think it's a waste, because I don't know that beating Big Show, if that's the idea, you know, really is going to mean much. I mean, think about it. What is that really going to mean? If you're a new guy, if they promote a new guy from NXT, and they say, we're going to put you in a feud with the Big Show, because beating the Big Show is a big deal. You know, this guy's a multiple-time world champion. He's a future Hall of Famer. He's a legend. He's a giant. And if you beat him, if you slay the giant, you'll be so over. I don't necessarily buy that, but fine. Maybe that's the case for a new guy from NXT. A guy like Cesaro, he's already been around for years. He's established. What is to be gained? If that were the idea, what is to be gained from a feud with the Big Show? They prostituted the Big Show on TV so much that the Big Show himself has said that he probably shouldn't be on TV as much as he is. That he's overexposed. That he's not being used the right way. This is from his own mouth. He admits this. So, if that's the plan, and I'm not convinced that it is, wouldn't shock me in the least if it was just done for the sake of doing it and making Big Show look like a badass and making, you know, Cesaro look like a schmuck. But if there is a feud that is going to come out of this now, and Cesaro gets a big win, you know, all right, but I don't really think it's going to mean much, because how impressive really is a win over the Big Show at this point? Is it really that impressive? And could they really do anything in a match that could top that moment from the end of the Battle Royal at WrestleMania last year? I mean, seriously, that will go down as one of the all-time great WrestleMania moments. You know, that they replay in video packages in the future. And they had a real chance to make that Andre Battle Royal feel like, all right, this actually means something, because this guy won the very first one, and wow, look where he is now. And you can't really say that about Cesaro. So the Andre Battle Royal, which was supposed to be this big special thing, and then, you know, Big Show goes and wins it this year, what does it really mean? It's nothing. It's a fucking throwaway match. So I don't want to see them make the same mistake twice with this guy. He went from the highest of highs in 2014 to the lowest of lows, and they're kind of falling back into that same trap now. He's building a lot of momentum. The people are into him, and they're getting more into him each week. But you've got to work with the guy. You can't just say, well, we're putting you on TV and the rest is up to you, but we're going to book you like shit. You know, the one thing that it's hard to overcome is bad booking. You got to go out there and do what they tell you to do. It doesn't matter how cool you look doing it or what fancy special moves you do. You've got to have some cooperation from the people who are writing the fucking show. And when you get knocked out like a jabron, it doesn't do you any favors. And I really do think they can make money off this guy. I really do. And I think people are tired of the same old shit and the same old faces and people like running around on that fucking hamster wheel. And then you have a week like this where they drop like a stone. You know, people are whatever they're watching, football, or they're just turning the TV off, whatever's going on. There's obviously a problem here. And, you know, the Cesaro thing is kind of a small little piece of it. So anyway, I wanted to say something about it because I just feel like they're wasting what they have in this guy. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that he's the next John Cena, he's the face of the company, because I don't think he is. But he could be doing a hell of a lot better than he is. And the people are open to the idea, why are you fighting it? That's the thing that kills me. Why are you making it harder for him to get over when he's finally building some momentum on his own? This horrible thing happened with his partner. You know, take advantage of it. Run with it. See how far he can go. The Dudleys beat Los Matadores who beat the snot out of El Torito, so I guess that pairing is over. The Matadors and the Bull are no more. Maybe they'll call up Bull Dempsey to save the little guy. Or eat him. Either way. John Cena and the Primetime Players against Seth Rollins in the New Day. I'm sure you saw the idiot fan who hopped the barricade and was walking down the aisle alongside Rollins. It felt like forever before security did something and tackled the guy and took him out of there. Not the first incident that we've had. We had the idiot who threw his money in the bank briefcase at Roman Reigns' head at that house show. We had Dean Ambrose nearly attacked by a fan. Some people say stabbed. He may have had a knife. I don't know. That was after a SmackDown taping. And now Rollins. Something about the Shield, man. I don't know what it is, but it's something about the Shield. It's very simple. You know, people asking, what can be done? We need a solution. It's a very simple solution. The next idiot who hops the barricade gets his ass kicked. That's it. You know, and I know why they won't do it, and I know why they can't do it, especially today. All PC takes one cell phone video, and that's the end of them. That's the end of WWE. They'll be paying out the nose. But I'm just saying, that's the easiest and most simplest way to get your message across. Don't hop the barricade. Don't do something stupid. Don't throw shit. You hop the barricade, you get taken backstage and locked in a room with Mark Henry. That's the punishment. Word gets around, trust me, people will think twice before they hop the barricade. Otherwise, they're just going to keep doing it. You know, they'll get on TV, they'll get on social media, people will put animated GIFs together, they'll become a meme, they'll become an internet celebrity for all of 10 minutes. So they're going to keep doing it. So lock them in a room with Mark Henry. One guy goes missing. Trust me, it'll never happen again. So John Cena pinned Kofi Kingston after an AA. Because why bother letting, you know, Titus O'Neil get the pin, especially since they're the ones getting a shot at the tag team titles on Raw this coming Monday night? I guess that would make too much sense. Cena did the millions of dollars dance with them after the match. They left. Seth Rollins got back in the ring. He was all dejected and upset. Second match he lost on this show. At least he didn't get pinned here. But he did lose two matches in one night. Sting popped up on the Titantron. The lights had been darkened, so every time Sting had been on the Tron all night long, it was just a dark black background. You saw Sting, and you saw the Rollins statue. So this time, the lights went on, and we saw that he was backstage. Why Rollins couldn't figure that out on his own and find Sting? He had 3 hours to find him. He was backstage the whole time. This was never explained. Seth, all he talked about all night was how important the statue was, and apparently he didn't bother to go looking for it. I guess he was busy getting ready for his matches. So Sting is backstage, there's a garbage truck, it's too bad he couldn't put this entire show into the garbage truck. There's the statue, he's teasing that he's going to tip it over, finally he pushes it over, the statue falls into the back of the garbage truck, and the workers hit the button or flip the switch or whatever they do, they work their magic touch, the machinery comes down and it crushes the statue. And Seth is beside himself, he has a conniption fit in the middle of the ring, Sting meanwhile hanging on to the back of the garbage truck, singing as the garbage truck drives away. This was as close to Joker Sting in TNA, I think, as we're going to get. It wasn't quite Joker Sting, but it was a much more jovial Sting. I love how we went from Sting, you know, 6 months ago, who barely said a word. Maybe he cut one promo. He didn't speak. Remember that one episode of Raw? That's not Sting. That's a picture of Sting. Sting would just show up, and he would stand there. And he really wouldn't say anything. And when he had something to say, I guess he had a fucking iPad connected to the Titantron. Because remember, he was typing messages to Triple H? All of a sudden, we went from Sting, who was very shy and wouldn't say a word, to a guy who can't shut up. You can't shut this guy up now. So off he went. I thought Sting was fine. I actually enjoy Sting when he shows some personality like that. If it was the Sting of old, if it was the old Crow Sting with the old Crow music up in the rafters and they kind of wanted to do it that way, that would be cool, but they're not doing Crow Sting. He's wearing the makeup and that's it. This is not Crow Sting. That Sting is dead, just like Surfer Sting. Surfer Sting is dead. He ain't coming back. The flat top ain't coming back unless he wears a wig. So this is kind of a hybrid mix, I guess, of Crow Sting and Joker Sting. And for what it was, I thought he was fine. He was very entertaining. Overall, the show was not very entertaining. I think the ratings reflected that. They're going all in on the season premiere this week. That's how they're advertising it. It's the season premiere of Monday Night Raw, which begs the question, if this is the season premiere, I guess, does that make this episode the season finale? And if so, easily one of the worst season finales I've ever seen. Season premiere this week against Monday Night Football. Good luck with that. Sting is going to be back on the show. It is, of course, the go-home show tonight of Champions, so I would expect him to be there. We have Charlotte trying to stop Nikki from breaking AJ's record. She'll tie the record no matter what. Nikki, that's the thing some people don't realize. Oh, I don't want her to break the record. You know, AJ should be the one at the top of the list. Let's not talk about Nikki. Nikki, you're going to have to talk about Nikki because Nikki is at the very least going to tie AJ. So from now on, if that's such a big deal to you, you mention AJ Lee having the record. Either way, you're going to have to mention Nikki Bella in the same breath. So she will tie the record, but they're trying to stop her from breaking the record and having sole possession of first place. Primetime players are also going to be getting a tag team title shot on the show against the New Day, so they actually promoted matches in advance. This is a unique thing that we don't see them do anymore. I wish they would do more of it. It's a shame that only when they feel threatened by another TV show. You notice how that works? When they're threatened by something else on television, it's like all of a sudden they pull their head out of their ass and they say, hey, maybe we should announce a big main event for next week, or maybe we should announce a card a week in advance. What a concept. I mean, it just goes to show you, if they still had some real competition like they used to, you know, 20 years ago, we'd probably be seeing a lot more of that. There is definitely something to be said for competition. And we're kind of seeing a little bit of that here with football. Now, I just wanted to say something real quick about the Stone Cold podcast. Austin had Edge and Christian on. I watched it. I thought it was fine. I mean, it wasn't really... I didn't really learn much in the way of anything new. But the one thing I have to say that I was disappointed in is that Austin didn't ask the one question that I thought he should have. And maybe there was a reason. Maybe they said, don't talk about this. Or they said to Christian, don't talk about this. I don't know if that they did that. But he should have asked him when it came to Christian, you know, do you consider yourself officially retired or not? I'm going to assume that he does just based on the way that Christian was talking about the career that he had. And it was almost like, you know, we know Edge is retired, but they were talking about Christian in the same way. But it was weird because there was never any formal, you know, aside from maybe a comment on commentary by Jerry Lawler that Christian at the time apparently disagreed with, there was never any kind of declaration that, hey, this guy is done. This guy is retired. He's finished. So at least if it's official, make it official. Bring it up. Ask the question. I don't understand how you can do an interview with Christian, who hasn't been on TV in months, and not ask the question, hey, dude, what's your status? What's up? What's going on here? You know, or why did your career come to an end the way it did? Edge told the story about what happened with him and getting the phone call from Vince McMahon. I don't understand why they couldn't do the same thing for Christian. I mean, if anything, if they're so worried about concussions and all that, which is why, you know, Christian is done, I don't know why you wouldn't bring it up. You know, they brought up the stuff about how they will not let Edge wrestle because of his neck. That tells me the WWE takes his health and his safety very seriously, and they're not going to let him do anything to jeopardize his well-being. Same thing with Christian. Why wouldn't you tell the story that, hey, you know, I had some concussion issues, WWE, they're very serious about that stuff now and the testing and everything, and so they wouldn't let me back in the ring, and it's kind of a similar situation to Edge. In an eerie kind of way, you could even talk about the fact that their careers ended in very similar fashion, but there was never any mention of what happened. So I just thought that was very weird, and you're going to do an interview with this guy. A lot of it was all, you know, jokey-jokey. It was entertaining, but how do you not ask that question? So I thought that was disappointing. That was the one question I thought Austin had to ask, and he didn't ask it. And that's surprising, because Austin is usually pretty on point with the questions that he asks in his interviews, more than anyone else. But if you didn't watch it, the one reason I would say you need to go watch it on the network, if no other reason, is simply to see the image of Edge and Christian playing the kazoo and Steve Austin wearing a little cowboy hat playing the, what the hell was it? Was it a banjo or a ukulele? Guitar? Was it a little, maybe it was like a mini guitar, which is basically what those things are anyway. Just the image of Austin sitting there with that stupid hat on his head. It reminded me of when he gave Kurt Angle the little cowboy hat during the invasion. The one good thing to come out of that invasion was the interplay with Kurt Angle and Steve Austin. It kind of reminded me of that a little bit. So you can go back and watch that part. But I thought the stuff about Christian, I just thought was a bit of a letdown.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
WWE made it official this week. They have signed female Japanese wrestler Kana to the NXT division, as they call it. She will report to the Performance Center later this month. They put out a press release that says, over the course of her 11-year career, Kana has become one of the most exciting women ever to compete in Japan. She has appeared in many organizations throughout the country and has held multiple championships. She was at the tapings this week with her new name. I don't read the NXT spoilers, but I did see this part. She will now be known as Asuka. She said Asuka means future. I guess as in she is the future of NXT. It's also a nod to Lioness Asuka, who is a huge name apparently in wrestling in Japan in the 80s. I was not aware of her, but apparently she was one of the top female names in all of Japan. So I'm sure that has a little something to do with that name. I think Kana sounds better myself, but I also still think Kenta sounds better than Hideo Itami. Kana and Kenta. Hey, if they would have let them keep their names, that would have been a hell of a pairing. Speaking of the tapings, WWE went and announced this on their Twitter account, so it's already official. It's not really a spoiler. At the next TakeOver special on October 7th, it looks like I'm getting a nice belated birthday gift because Bayley and Sasha Banks will have a 30-minute... Now, they're calling it an Iron Man match, but I pitched an idea on Twitter. I think they should call it an Iron Maiden match, because how much more badass does that sound? I mean, come on. Yeah, they're both young, unmarried. The word fits. A 30-minute Iron Maiden match for the NXT Women's Championship. Let's all tweet that to them. Let's tweet that to Sasha and Bayley and Triple H and make it happen. Even better is that they're promoting it as the main event of TakeOver. NXT does the Divas Revolution better than Raw does. They can get away with doing that, though, because there won't be an NXT title match on that show. They'll have the finals of the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, which, yeah, that doesn't have to go on last. In fact, if Joe and Balor go all the way to the finals of that tournament, they can shoot the angle there to lead to a championship match between them at the London TakeOver in December. So, you know, no title match on this show. Why not give the women a chance to shine in the main event? I love it. I think it's a great idea. I can't wait. I think the match itself is going to be fucking great. Iron Man matches are hard because, you know, you're telling people in advance, hey, this thing is going to go X number of minutes. It's going to go 60. It's going to go 30. 30 is a little easier, but that's still a long time, especially for the women. I don't think we've ever seen a 30-minute women's match in WWE, ever. Ever in the history of the company. Except maybe that one Survivor Series. I think it was the first Survivor Series. They had this giant 10 or 12 woman Survivor Series. I mean, maybe something like that has gone half an hour. But I can't remember a tag team match or a singles match with the women that has ever gone even remotely that long. So it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a test. But in these kinds of matches, you know, people have an expectation that nothing exciting is going to happen in the first 10 or 15 minutes. So, you know, they may be more apt to just sit on their phone, kind of check out until later in the match. I don't think that's going to be as much of an issue at Full Sail for this match. I think these people are going to help make this a special match. But I'm just saying, when you announce to people in advance that the match is going to go at least 30 minutes, I think it handicaps it in a way. And part of what I'm looking forward to here is seeing how these two women put this thing together. You know, can they top the magic of Brooklyn? That's going to be tough. I'm trying not to, you know, compare it. I'm gonna look at this match kind of on its own. But it's tough, you know. That Brooklyn match was a perfect storm. You know, it was the biggest show they've done yet. Big crowd. The people were into it. They had built that Bayley story up for like 2 years of her chasing the championship and constantly losing and losing. And Sasha was such a great heel, talking about how, you know, you're not good enough, you're never going to make it, all of us have been called up and not you for a reason. And then the match itself just kicked all kinds of ass in the finish. So, I mean, that match was kind of perfect on its own. And, you know, we'll see if they can come up with something completely different and blow people away on this show. But I do think that point about the Iron Man matches is a valid one, though. And
I think, you know, people will say that the Bret Hart Shawn Michaels match at WrestleMania 12 is this all-time classic, and it's not a bad match at all, but I think it's one of the more overrated matches in WWE history. I can't say the most overrated. I mean, it may be, but it's one of the most overrated matches in the history of that company, because you had these two guys, two of the best they've ever had, who you expect, if you put them in a match, they're just going to blow everybody away, and oh my God, it's 60 minutes, how could this be a bad match? But the crowd was bored for a good part of it, and I wonder, you know, if you had Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels as the main event of WrestleMania 12, but didn't add the Iron Man stipulation. At that time, I think championship matches had like a 60-minute time limit. If you just let these guys go for the full 60 minutes or, you know, 51 minutes, but never told people in advance it was going to go an hour, I think it actually would have made the match better. Because people would not have been expecting the match to go that long. Now, maybe they would have known something was up putting it on that early in the show. Maybe that would have been a tip-off, but it's one of those things where sometimes it can work against you when you announce in advance, hey, we're going to go X number of minutes. But this won't be the Arrowhead Pond or wherever that match was. This is going to be at Full Sail, a very different crowd, a much smaller crowd. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. I'm looking forward to this a lot. They did something pretty cool on NXT this week. They aired highlights of some of the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic matches that have taken place at some of the house shows. These buildings look like maybe they can fit 300 people. But I like it. You know, it helps make the thing feel special. They showed Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy beating Angelo Dawkins and Sawyer Fulton to advance. Dash Wilder and Scott Dawson beat Tucker Knight and Elias Sampson, the Drifter. Soon he'll be drifting to another promotion if they don't find something for him to do. Carmella beat the debuting Peyton Royce with her leg scissors submission, where she clamps her legs around her opponent's neck and wrenches back. Carmella did the moonwalk during the match and again when it was over, which they credited to Michael Hayes and said Michael Jackson learned it from him. I hope there was no sharp objects laying around Webmaster Mike's house when he heard that. First round match in the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa against Tyler Breeze and Bull Dempsey. Dempsey mocked Breeze's deal where he poses on the top rope. The fans cheered when he did it. This is a nice little odd couple tag team here, at least for 1 week. See, and what did I tell you? I told you the guy was going to end up being a big baby face. Fans were chanting, Bull Fit. This is Bull Fit. Bull is gorgeous. They need to stop serving liquor at Full Sail. It's a college. I mean, come on now. Gargano and Ciampa look good here, especially Gargano. He could be something special if they were to sign him to an actual contract. I don't think he or Ciampa have signed full-time NXT deals, but I don't know that for sure. Bull went for a tag at one point. Breeze had been knocked off the apron by Gargano, so no one was there. And then when Breeze climbed back up on the apron, Bull hit the ropes and accidentally knocked him off to the floor. That allowed Ciampa to win with a sloppy-looking roll-up on Bull Dempsey, so Ciampa and Gargano advance in the tournament. After the match, Tyler Breeze laid a vicious beatdown on Bull Dempsey. And maybe it was just me, but as Breeze walked out, he kept looking back at the ring. He stopped. He turned around. It was almost like he was having regrets about what he had just done. I don't know if that's leading to anything. I don't know if it's going to end up being a more permanent pairing between the two of them. They'll become that odd couple team that I just talked about. Or if it was nothing, but it looked like he almost had remorse for what he had just done. Just, you know, just a little thing that I noticed. Dana Brooke pinned Billie Kay, the second Australian female on the show tonight, with her sitting Death Valley driver. The Dana Brooke thing, I don't know. She's winning some people over. I see more Dana Brooke love online now than I did, you know, a month or two ago. She's improving, you know, bit by bit, but I'm not buying what she's selling. I don't know. There's just something about her. I don't know if it's just she comes off to me as like one of the old divas that you would see on Raw like 6 or 7 years ago. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But I guess as somebody who came into this cold and didn't come from like an indie wrestling background or anything like that, she's not bad. I'm just not I'm not sold on her yet. We had a backstage interview with Apollo Crews, referring to the fans as the Apollo Nation. Now I desperately want them to run a show at the Apollo Theater and put him in the main event. Main event of this show was another first-round match in the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. Finn Balor and Samoa Joe against the Lucha Dragons. This match was taped a few weeks ago when SmackDown was in Providence, Rhode Island. So it was our first chance to see Balor and Joe wrestling in a full-size WWE arena. And for the record, they look like they fit in perfectly. We had Tom Phillips and Jimmy Uso providing commentary for the match. It was pretty short, went about 9 or 10 minutes. This was a WWE-style match, not the kind of match I think both these teams are capable of. Balor and Joe took most of it. Nothing overly flashy other than a Balor dive out to the floor at one point. Kalisto got a near fall on Joe with a Hurricanrana into a pinning attempt, like Rey Mysterio used to do. Joe got him with the Muscle Buster, though, followed by the coup de grace from Finn Balor for the win. So they advance in the tournament. I expect them to go all the way to the end and probably fall short, and it leads to a championship match between them at the next TakeOver show. I think Balor and Joe for the title as the next feud makes a lot of sense. Some TNA news. Kurt Angle was on Mark Madden's radio show this week. He said he would not be re-signing with TNA when his current contract ends in January. He said he's not going to try to get back into WWE. He's going to take a break from pro wrestling, which he probably should have done about at least 5 years ago. He'll be back in the ring for TNA at a house show on October 3rd, and then the next night for Bound for Glory in North Carolina. Yes, believe it or not, TNA has a pay-per-view coming up in just a few weeks. Which begs the question, if a pay-per-view airs and no one watches it, did it really air? Angle was asked about TNA's TV situation. He said no one has said anything to him. That seems to be the case with all the talent in TNA. No one is keeping them in the loop on what's going on. That's the TNA way. They still have no new taping scheduled for next month. As of right now, according to PW Insider, Destination America has Impact listed on its internal schedule through Wednesday, October 7th, which is the night of the next TakeOver show. I don't know if they have enough TV tape to go longer than that. They could end up, you know, extending that out a bit more, I guess, if they do. Maybe right now it's going through October 7th, and maybe in another couple of weeks they'll extend that out to October 14th, and they'll just keep airing Impact. It's very possible. It's very possible that they'll keep Impact going a little bit longer. But as of today, the date is October 7th. As far as Kurt goes, he said he's leaving TNA. He's not looking to sign with WWE. But he didn't say anything about Global Force Wrestling. And he and Jeff Jarrett are on great terms now, despite the stuff with Karen that went down a few years ago and there was a lot of heat there. All is well now. If they wanted him to come in and work some shows, I could see him doing that. I know he said he was taking a full break, but this is Kurt Angle we're talking about here. He won't be able to stay away for very long. Selfishly, I would love to see Kurt back in WWE for one last big WrestleMania match against either Daniel Bryan or Brock Lesnar or Seth Rollins. You know, Rollins, I think, would also be a great opponent for him. The match with Bryan, you know, if he did Kurt Angle and Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania, I can picture it being a lumberjack match with the lumberjacks all being members of the WWE medical staff. They're all just standing there with, like, latex gloves and shock paddles waiting for something bad to happen. I'd still like to see it, though. One more TNA note. I got a message from one of our longtime listeners, Scotty. He was over there in Nashville, around where TNA headquarters are. Apparently, they're inside a big building with a bunch of other companies. He didn't go inside. He went inside the building. He didn't go inside the TNA office. He was kind of hanging around outside, and you can see through the glass. I guess you need a passcode to get in. But he did snap a photo through the glass doors, and you see two giant pictures hanging on the wall in the waiting area by the receptionist desk. One is a photo of Dixie Carter, of course. And the other is a photo of Hulk Hogan. Not Kurt Angle. Not Sting. Not AJ Styles, not even Jeff Jarrett or somebody like that, Samoa Joe, nope, Hulk Hogan. I just thought that was sad. All they're missing is a photo of Vince Russo, and they'll have themselves a wall of shame. Ring of Honor on Destination America. Only two matches this week, but that's all they needed. They were two great matches. Easily the best hour of wrestling on TV all week. We started out with the ROH World Tag Team titles on the line, The Addiction, Almighty Christopher Daniels and Frankie Kazarian with Chris Sabin in their corner against the Young Bucks. They didn't waste any time with the super kicks here. Two for Kazarian right at the bell. The Bucks were out for revenge for what The Addiction had done to them a few weeks ago, laying them out. More super kicks for Sabin outside the ring after the referee sent Sabin to the back. He got tossed and he was trying to come back, but he ate a pair of super kicks. I thought this was fun. This was a fun match. Bucks nailed an Indy Taker near the finish, had the match won. Daniels yanked the referee out of the ring right before the three count. The last possible second, he yanked the referee out of the ring. Great heat for that. You know, we used to get that all the time in those Attitude Era title matches. I just watched one the other day. We had Steve Austin and The Undertaker. It was on Raw. It was from 99, the summer of 99. He hit the stunner. Earl Hebner's about to count the three, and fucking Paul Bearer pulls him out of the ring at the last second. People were going apeshit. And so were the people here. Daniels grabs one of the title belts. He wallops Nick with it. I think it was Nick. He tries to use it to hit the other Buck, but he eats a super kick. That Young Buck picks up the title, hits Kazarian with it. The Kingdom is out there already at this point. Matt Taven, Mike Bennett, and Maria Kanellis. The Kingdom is getting the next tag team title shot at their All-Star Extravaganza pay-per-view this Friday. So they're out there. Bennett jumps up on the apron. He gets whacked with the belt. Maria grabs the belt out of the out of Matt's hand. I think it was Matt's hand. And Matt's looking at her like he's thinking about the super kick. The fans are chanting super kick. And as he's about to do it, he's about to kick her in the face. Kazarian rolls him up from behind, gets the three count. A distraction roll-up on Ring of... I just realized that. A fucking distraction roll-up here in this match on ROH TV in the same week. We got two on Raw. So it's like a virus now. It's back. So The Addiction retained. Fans are pissed. Nigel McGuinness walks out, says he's not going to let this stand. So naturally, everybody's thinking, all right, he's going to restart the match. And people are all excited. And then Nigel says what he's going to do is make the Decades match with the Ascension. Yeah, right. Yeah, there's a match we need to see. Now, he said he's going to make the Decades match with the Addiction at the pay-per-view now. A three-way for the tag team titles that now includes the Young Bucks. And the fans booed because they were pissed. They thought they were going to get the title match right then and there. They didn't want to wait. So anyway, World Championship match, Jay Lethal with Truth Martini, Jay Diesel, and Donovan Dijak of the House of Truth against Mr. Ring of Honor himself, Roderick Strong. These are two of the best in the world right now. They went 60 minutes in their last match. They didn't go 60 this time. They still went every bit of 20. Great match. Roddy is one of those guys that you figure is probably a total pro, probably very safe to work with, but I would be terrified to wrestle him. It just looks painful. It looks unpleasant to be on the receiving end of pretty much anything that Roderick Strong does. Maybe it really is, or maybe he's just that damn good at what he does. But I would not want to take a chop from him. I would not want to take a kick from him. No thank you. He gave Jay Lethal a drop kick in the first, it had to be the first minute, 90 seconds maybe of the match, that looked and sounded as sick as any drop kick you'll ever see. Something went flying. I think it was one of the braids in Lethal's hair, but the announcers, like all wrestling announcers do, they said, oh, it was a tooth that went flying. It could have been. And Lethal was awesome here. He fell out of the ring like he was out on his feet. He fell between the middle and bottom ropes and hit the floor. A simple drop kick. One drop kick. And this was awesome. This was right after the match started. So that set the tone for what was to come. I'm skipping ahead here. There was a sick kick by Roddy, Lethal kicked out. House of Truth got involved. The belt, the book, right? Truth Martini's book. All of it came into play. Lethal eventually hits a belt shot on Strong, follows it up with a lethal injection, one of my favorite finishes in all of wrestling right now. Strong kicks out. Place goes nuts. Lethal has this incredulous look on his face. He can't believe it. Lethal hits a super kick and hits a second lethal injection and finally gets the three count and retains the championship. This was a hell of a match. Jay Lethal continues to be booked strong as world champion. Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish walk out from behind the curtain. They stare down Lethal. Bobby Fish is going to challenge Lethal for the TV title at the next pay-per-view, and later that same night, O'Reilly challenges Lethal for the World Championship. And if that sounds familiar, it's because Ring of Honor booked it first, before someone in WWE who watches ROH said, hey, that's a great idea. Let's have Rollins do the same thing. So I guess we'll see who has the better matches. Lethal at All-Star Extravaganza or Rollins at Night of Champions. Rollins is wrestling a 56-year-old man in one of those matches. Lethal is wrestling Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish. So I guess it's a little unfair to compare, but who cares? Let's get to the mailbag. Like I said earlier, I wanted to dedicate a good portion of the time here to your questions. I thought that would be the appropriate thing to do here on the 400th episode. You can email me, of course, as always, same as it's always been from episode one, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Alex from Toronto. My question regards the Rock's WWE contract expiring in 2005. I've heard numerous accounts of what happened, from WWE management simply forgetting to re-sign him, to Vince not wanting any part-time contracts for wrestlers who were not 100% committed to WWE after getting burned by Brock Lesnar, and even Triple H getting in Vince's ear to let the contract expire, assuming or maybe hoping The Rock would fail in Hollywood and then they could sign him later to a cheaper deal. Is there any truth to any of these rumors, and if so, was there heat between WWE and The Rock, which led to him not reappearing until 2011, aside from the one Hall of Fame and some pre-recorded promos? That was a weird one. What happened was Rock's contract was expiring at the end of 2004, and nobody from WWE ever reached out to him about re-signing a new deal. They just let it quietly run out without so much as a phone call. And then suddenly people are contacting Rock going, hey, you know, congrats on the great career, and he's like, what? You know, that's news to me, but okay. He was already coming up with ideas on possible opponents for WrestleMania 21. He was the one who got Goldberg to come in 2003 so he could work a match with him. I believe for WrestleMania in 2005, he wanted to maybe work a match with Sting or try to work a match with Randy Savage, which was, you know, had no chance of happening. So it's not like Rock was checked out and done with wrestling and was leaving it behind for movies. I mean, he was definitely interested in signing a new deal and sticking around, at least for, you know, the big WrestleMania match. And WWE just let his contract run out like he was some kind of jabroni that creative had nothing for. And WWE put a statement out at the time claiming it was a clerical oversight. You know, that's where the heat came from. There absolutely was heat between them for that, and resentment, and it led to him not doing anything with the company for years. You know, it was a respect thing. This is one of the biggest stars in your entire company, and because of a clerical oversight, you let his contract run out? I don't buy that. I don't believe that for a second. What the real reason was, nobody knows. It's all speculation. What I had always heard is that they thought his movie career would flop and he'd come, you know, crawling back and they can get him at a cheaper price tag, which, again, that was the prevailing rumor. Doesn't mean that was actually the reason. I never heard that Triple H was involved, but nothing would surprise me. You know, there was always a professional jealousy there with The Rock. Ric Flair, on his podcast with Bruce Pritchard last month, this is only a few weeks ago, he had Bruce Pritchard on his show, and Flair still thinks the two of them hate each other in real life. You know, he's like, I don't even know that Rock and Hunter like each other now. And Flair is close with Triple H. So that tells you right there, if that's what Flair thinks, or if that's what he's hearing, or that's what he's been led to believe, you know, it tells you right there where he's getting that from. There's always been a jealousy there. I mean, I'll never forget, Shawn Michaels had just come back. This was in 2002. When he joined the NWO for all of like 3 weeks before they disbanded the group once and for all. Shawn Michaels is, you know, this changed man of God, barely back on TV after 4 years away, and he takes a cheap shot at The Rock. This was the night he superkicked Booker T out of the NWO, and he compared Booker T stealing the spotlight from the rest of the NWO to Rock trying to steal the spotlight from Triple H. You would think they were setting up a Rock versus Shawn Michaels match at some point, but nope. It was just Shawn Michaels being a dick for no reason. Triple H was a babyface on SmackDown at the time. Had nothing to do with the NWO. I think Rock was also a babyface on the SmackDown roster. There was no reason for him to say what he said. There was no reason to make the comment. But that tells you the mentality at the time of what those guys really thought. They thought Rock was stealing Triple H's spotlight for years. That tells you how they saw things back then. I honestly think it goes back to Rock getting the big push in 97. I think it goes all the way back to when he came in as, you know, the blue chipper, and he got the big push right out of the gate, and Triple H, who came in before him, busting his ass, literally having to wrestle in pig shit, and then being the fall guy for the curtain call and getting punished for it. All of a sudden, here comes this green kid with bad hair, and they're pushing the hell out of him. And not only was it too much too soon for The Rock, his first big win was over Triple H for the Intercontinental title. It was only a few months after Triple H won it. And Rock's run as champion was a failure, and they took it off him, I think, 3 months later. They put it on Owen Hart. You know, and then they became ultra-competitive during the Attitude Era because they were fighting for the same spot. You know, their careers, in a lot of ways, really mirrored each other a lot. And I think that's why Rock and Triple H was such a great feud in the Attitude Era, and they had those great matches and the promo battles because it was real. It felt real. They were drawing off real emotions that they had for each other. You know, not as real maybe as Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels felt. I mean, that felt real enough that it was actually uncomfortable to watch on some weeks, the way they were ripping on each other and the things they were saying. But that's why I'm cool with them having a match at next year's WrestleMania. If that's the plan, to maybe do Rock versus Triple H one last time, if they play off their history and they really let loose on promos the way they kind of let John Cena and The Rock take off the gloves and let loose and go, you know, a little non-PG for some of their promos, I think it would make for great television. But did Triple H have any influence over what happened with The Rock's contract? That I don't know. I've never heard that before. This comes from Luis, not Facebook Luis. This is a different one. We're 7 months away from WrestleMania, and it looks like WWE may have their top matches already decided on. And with what they currently have, do you think they will A, beat the WrestleMania 3 record of 93,173, B, reach the 100,000 mark, C, take back the indoor attendance record that stands at 108,713 from the NBA All-Star Game in 2010, or D, none of the above? I didn't realize they had that many people there for the All-Star Game. I don't know. That's crazy. 108,000. I don't know what the setup was for the NBA All-Star Game, but remember, WWE has a gigantic stage setup, so even if that was a legit number, there's no way they'd be able to fit that many people in there for WrestleMania, so that number is pretty much untouchable for WWE. Here's my prediction. I mean, I don't even know what the card is. I just mentioned maybe Rock vs. Triple H is a match that they're going to do. You know, you would think maybe Undertaker and Sting. I think it's more likely we get, you know, the rubber match between Brock and The Undertaker to kind of cap off that feud. Beyond that, I don't really know what the matches are for WrestleMania. I don't really have a better sense now than I did a few months ago. I mean, I think it'll become clearer a few months from now. I'm sure they have a few of the top matches already penciled in their brain as far as what they want to do. But here's my prediction, my early prediction. I think that they will claim, it doesn't even matter what card they have, I think they're going to claim somewhere between 95,000 and 100,000. But the actual number itself will probably end up being around 80,000. Maybe like 80 to 83,000 maybe, in that range. But they'll announce it somewhere between 95 and 100 so they could break the WrestleMania 3 record. That's my prediction. They will break the WrestleMania 3 record. With whatever number they announced. I mean, they ain't coming close to that NBA All-Star record, but I think they want to break that WrestleMania 3 record, and they can do that just by having the number sit somewhere between 95 and 100, so that's my prediction. Terry says, do you think the Total Divas show is ruining Paige's anti-diva character? What anti-diva character? There is none. She hasn't been the anti-diva since she debuted on Raw. That character was left in the rearview mirror at NXT. I don't even think they ever called her that again after she left NXT. So she hasn't been the anti-diva at all since she debuted on Raw. Samarth from Bangalore, India. Back in 2009, what was the controversy that led to CM Punk losing the world title to Undertaker at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view? I remember hearing that it had something to do with some comments Punk had made backstage about someone's wardrobe. I don't know if that's why he lost the world title. They may have already had that planned. But the story, what happened is that Undertaker was on a European tour with Punk. Punk was world champion at the time. And Undertaker took issue with how CM Punk was dressed on the tour. And suggested that, you know, now that you're the world champion, you should dress up a little bit better, dress nicely. And instead of saying, you know, thank you, sir, and moving on with his day, Punk responded with something to the effect of, well, what about John Cena? And so that ended up getting back to management, and Punk got a lot of heat for it. So, but did that lead to him being stripped of the world title? You can't say for sure. Maybe they were going to take it off him anyway. But that was the incident that happened. Samarth also wants to know, can you talk about the plane ride from hell in 2002? It's still one of the more popular questions I get. I know I've covered it on the show before, but to give the quick summary, there was a charter flight. I think they were coming back from an overseas tour in 2002. They had alcohol served on the flight, and there were a whole bunch of different incidents that happened. Brock Lesnar and Mr. Perfect, I think that was the flight where they got into the fight in the aisle. They were wrestling around and crashed into the door, and the door could have opened. And if that would have happened, it would have ended in tragedy. So I could be wrong. Maybe that was on a different flight, but I'm pretty sure that was on the plane ride from hell. So you have Brock Lesnar and Mr. Perfect are wrestling around. You have Goldust, who is probably drunk out of his mind, on the PA system singing love songs to his ex-wife, Terry, and making her very uncomfortable. You have Michael Hayes, who fell asleep, and I think X-Pac, while Hayes was sleeping, cut off his ponytail and like taped it to the wall or something. I mean, there was a whole bunch of different things going on the flight. I think either Scott Hall or Ric Flair flashed one of the stewardesses, and they may have sued after the fact. It was like four or five different things happening on this flight. You would think it was a fucking high school class. And, you know, after that, I don't know that they ever served alcohol in any of those charter flights again. But or actually, maybe they don't even do charter flights anymore. I think they all just fly commercial. And it might be because of that plane ride from hell. So, I mean, if you look it up, you'll see some of the other details online about what happened. But that's kind of the crux of what happened. A lot of different stupid things happened on one flight that made the company look really, really bad. And it could have turned out to be a disaster, especially if Brock and Mr. Perfect had... Can you imagine that? They're wrestling around and they crash into the door. No parachutes. They just kind of tumble out of the plane as they're still wrestling. It's like something out of a fucking James Bond movie. All because Perfect was trying to goad Brock into a fight to see who the better amateur wrestler was. I mean, him and Brock were friends. It wasn't like they hated each other. They were actually really good friends. And Perfect was just, you know, being a dick, as he was, you know, known to do, or known to be sometimes. And I think he got fired for it. I think Perfect actually got fired as a result of what happened on that plane. And then the next year, he died. Nick from Germany. How do you think the career of Brian Pillman would have evolved if he would not have died? He would have gone back to WCW. At the time of his death, Pillman wanted to go back to WCW, which I could never understand because he had a good thing going with the Hart Foundation, but I guess WCW, you know, was the number one promotion at the time, and maybe he thought he can get a better deal, more money. But I know, you know, Dave Meltzer was very close with Brian Pillman, and Pillman would speak to him all the time during those years, and he made it very clear he wanted to go back to WCW. And I'll tell you what, if he had lived a month later when Montreal happened, he would have been gone anyway, because there's no way Pillman would have stuck around after that. Out of loyalty to Bret Hart alone, he would have wanted out. I mean, they all did. Bulldog paid $150,000 out of his own pocket just to buy his contract out so he can go to WCW. That's how badly he wanted out. Neidhart left. Owen Hart would have left, but Vince wouldn't let him out of his deal. Imagine if he had. Talk about changing the course of history. So I have no doubt that Pillman would have wanted out of his contract too. Now, if Pillman had stayed in WWE, I think he would have been a natural first challenger for Austin's title after WrestleMania 14 instead of Dude Love. Pillman in the Attitude Era Are you kidding me? He would have fit like a glove. You know, the problem was his ankle. He had that horrible car wreck. He was like was he in a Humvee? I don't know what he was in, but he wrapped his car around a tree, really just completely destroyed his ankle. It had to be fused together. He was never the same. And he was always in constant pain, probably popping pills left and right. And he couldn't really do much in the ring anymore. But I think a match or two with Steve Austin feuding over the championship, I think would have been fine. I think he probably could have he could have gotten through that. For the promos alone, in that era, without the restrictions and the handcuffs of PG today, can you imagine Austin and Pillman in the Attitude Era cutting promos on each other? Holy shit. It would have been awesome. Stacy from Oakland, California. Booker T recently said he has no intention to ever wrestle again unless it's a match between Harlem Heat and the Dudley Boys. While the nostalgic part of me would love to see this match, realistically, I don't see it as being any good. The Dudleys really haven't lost a step, and they're still in great shape, but Booker, I believe, hasn't wrestled in 4 or 5 years, and I have no idea what Stevie Ray is up to. What do you think? Would you like to see Booker do one more match with Harlem Heat? Well, he and Stevie Ray are already doing that. They've teamed up recently in Booker's Reality of Wrestling promotion that he runs down in Texas, which is, as luck would have it, where WrestleMania happens to be next year, in Texas. And that's the place I'd like to see the match. Right now, I want to see the Dudleys working with new teams like New Day, Primetime Players, the Wyatt family. But come WrestleMania time next year, you know, they want to put a big card on, get 100,000 fans in that stadium. They're going to have to use some nostalgia to get those people in that building. I think a Dudleys versus Harlem Heat match as a special attraction, not for the tag team titles. You know, we don't need to see those two teams fighting over the belts, but just as an attraction on its own, I think would be a great idea. And I think Harlem Heat can still go. We know the Dudleys can still go. I'd love to see it. Jeremy says, Steve Austin is undoubtedly the biggest moneymaker the wrestling industry has ever seen. However, I always wonder why, by 2002, they seemed to flush him down the toilet, putting him in feuds with Scott Hall and Ric Flair, before their biggest slap in the face, trying to shotgun book Brock Lesnar to go over him on an episode of Raw. My question is, if Stone Cold never left the company in 2002, where would he have gone? How would you have booked him? And why is it that Stone Cold was tossed into the mid-card territory so abruptly, yet WWE continues to latch on to guys like Cena, even after 8 long years of stale, repetitive storylines? Well, it's a little more than 8 years, but yeah, the Austin stuff, it's not so simple. So you mentioned Scott Hall and Ric Flair. Austin, as I understand it, could have wrestled Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania that year if he wanted to. He did not want to wrestle Hulk Hogan, so they went with The Rock. So they could have done Austin versus Hogan at WrestleMania 18. Austin didn't want to have any part of that. That was his decision. As far as Ric Flair, I don't know, you know, what the idea was there, but you know, that was a pretty big feud for him to be involved in. Ric Flair was still a big name. Ric Flair, I think, was the GM of Raw, or whatever his official title was. And I wouldn't be surprised if Austin even maybe requested it and said he wanted to work with Flair. It was probably a thrill for him to be able to work some matches with Ric Flair in 02. The stuff with Brock, you know, why would they do that? Why would they book Steve Austin to lose in an opening round match or a qualifying match, whatever it was, in the King of the Ring tournament on Raw? Why would they book a match at all between Brock and Austin without some pay-per-view buildup? That's a good question. That's why Austin left. The answer is because they were not happy with comments that Austin had made about creative. Austin, even then, I mean, more so now with his podcast, but back then, even while he was working for the company, he was very critical of creative. And there was an interview that he did, and he spoke out of turn, and he said the creative was shit, or whatever it was that he said, and he got heat for it. And as his punishment, they were going to job him out to Brock Lesnar in a random match on Raw. And that's when Austin said, fuck you, I'm going home. Which he admits now was the biggest mistake he ever made. He says it was the biggest mistake he ever made because he lost a lot of money. you know, does he feel, you know, his other reasons were valid? I don't know. He says now it was a mistake, but that's why he left. And Austin had a lot of stuff going on back then, you know, physically, and he was in a bad place. So it all kind of bubbled up, and he left. And it took 8 or 9 months to get him back. And he had, what, 2 more matches, and then he was done. His neck was just all messed up. But that was the biggest reason. He was very openly critical and vocal about creative and the creative process, and it came back to bite him. And that's why they booked the match the way that they had booked the match. And Austin saw that and said, no way. There's no way I'm doing that. Now, how should they have used Austin? I think Austin and Lesnar could have been a huge match. Huge match on pay-per-view. And it should have been for the championship. So what I would have done, I would have kept Austin in the mix, you know, near the top. I would have ended up putting the title back on Austin one more time. And I would have built to a match at a pay-per-view between Brock and Austin. They could have even built that thing up as the main event of WrestleMania the next year. And that could have ended up being Austin's last match. He puts over Brock for the championship on his way out. Again, there were a lot of questions about Austin's neck. I mean, could he have even gone that long? Could he have survived a match with Brock Lesnar? Who knows? But that's how I would have done it. I would have gotten that belt back on Austin a few months later, and I would have built to a match with him and Brock. Maybe if they didn't want to wait that long, they could have done it at Survivor Series. Even SummerSlam, I just felt, you know, that would have been too quick of a turnaround, probably. I mean, I guess they could have done that. You know, when they tried to book the match with Austin in June, SummerSlam would have been 2 months. I still think it would have been too soon, but that would have been the way to do it. You want to do a Brock Lesnar, Steve Austin match, do it the right way. Don't just throw it out there as some random match on TV. I can understand why he was pissed. You know, I'm not saying you just walk out like that, but I can understand he had every right to be pissed off. And that's the big difference between Austin and a guy like Cena. Cena knows his place. You will never hear John Cena in an interview on the Today Show, TMZ, Sports Illustrated, like Bret Hart. Bret Hart has a Legends deal with the company. He don't give a fuck. That's part of what I love about Bret Hart. He goes out there and he speaks his mind. And if he thinks something is garbage, he'll say it. You know, Owen Hart, his brother, has a DVD coming out. I'm looking forward to it. And they interviewed Bret for it. And Bret, you know, I'm sure you've heard by now, Bret did the interview with John Pollock of The Law. He was interviewing him, and he was asking him about the Owen DVD. And Bret said, this is what he said. He actually said, it's the shits. Now, he then admitted a few minutes later he hasn't even seen the DVD yet. I don't know how you can call it the shits if you haven't seen it. But he said he was interviewed for it. He could tell just by the questions they were asking him and the questions that they didn't ask him. They felt very handcuffed by his widow, Martha, and she kind of sabotaged the whole project, and it's going to be garbage. I hope that's not true. I hope it's not garbage. Bret doesn't even really know, because he admits he hasn't seen the fucking thing yet, but, you know, he didn't pull any punches. You would think, you know, there's this DVD coming out, WWE's going to want to sell it, he's Owen's brother, hey, we could send Bret out there to promote it. If I'm WWE, I'm rethinking that strategy. I don't know that my strategy is, hey, let's deploy Bret Hart to go out and promote this DVD and call it the shits. But Bret is very honest when it comes to stuff like that, and Austin is the same way. John Cena is not. And you can say whatever you want about John Cena. It's smart. He's in a great position. He makes a lot of money. I'm sure he loves what he does. I'm sure that John Cena thinks a lot of the creative ideas, whether it involves him or it involves other people, that they suck. But John Cena is not going to go out there like Steve Austin did back then and actually tell people, hey, I don't like what they're doing. I think it sucks, or I think it's stupid. And that's why you'll never see John Cena, you know, get heat for saying something stupid like that and get pushed down like some mid-carder, because he knows his role. He knows his place. He doesn't speak out of turn. And that's what WWE likes about him. There's nothing unpredictable about John Cena. That's why he's safe. He is the most predictable guy they have, and that's what they love about him. That's why he's still on top after fucking 10 years, 12 years, whatever it's been. It's not a mystery why John Cena is still on top. He's predictable. He's the safe choice. Why do you think Randy Orton was never the guy? Randy Orton is another one. He'll speak his mind. You never know what's going to come out of Randy Orton's mouth. He always looks inherently pissed off, you know? He's not the most personable guy. He could be a little bit of a time bomb. You never know what he's going to say. John Cena, you don't have that problem. And so that kind of haunted Austin and led to that whole scenario, which then led to him walking out. This is from Xavier, not Woods. I can still remember Tatanka and his undefeated streak. Out of nowhere, Ludwig Borga came in and pretty much destroyed Tatanka. My question is, whatever happened to Borga? He shot himself. That's what happened. He's dead. I remember Borga, Ludwig Borga from Helsinki, Finland. I remember Tatanka's undefeated streak, too. 2 years he went undefeated. And then Borga came in, and a few months later he beat Tatanka. I think he used a chair behind the ref's back or something, and he pinned him, like, with his pinky, and it was played up as a big deal, and Borga feuded for a little bit with Lex Luger. Think about that. Had Lex Luger won the championship at SummerSlam that year, he likely would have been feuding with Ludwig Borga for the championship. That's a scary thought. I think Borga broke his ankle in early 94. Something happened with his ankle. He hurt the ankle and he was gone right after that. But he came from a boxing background. He's kind of an interesting guy if you look up his background. He came from a boxing background. He did some mixed martial arts. I remember his cameo in the third Die Hard movie, Die Hard with a Vengeance. Great fucking movie, by the way. Someone needs to take that scene of Bruce Willis standing in the middle of Harlem with the sign around his neck that says, I hate, and the N-word, and somehow edit Hulk Hogan's head onto Bruce Willis's body. See, there's an idea for Matthew's next Botchamania ending. Somebody's got to let him know. Borga was in that Die Hard movie. He was one of the terrorists dressed up as a police officer. He was the one who didn't want to sit in the back of the cop car with the bomb in the briefcase. Very, very brief cameo, but I remember when I first saw the movie, I said, is that Ludwig Borga? I didn't see the movie until many years later, but I knew right away once I saw him, I said, I know that guy. But anyway, after that, I know he got into politics in Finland. He was actually a politician, believe it or not. There were some scandals with him that happened. He was heavy into drinking and drugs and steroids and all that stuff, and he committed suicide. This was several years ago, maybe like 6-7 years ago. So it's kind of a tragic story, I guess. I don't get the impression he was a very nice guy, but definitely interesting. He led a very interesting life. Sherrod from Dallas. Could you tell me how WWE did those tricks with the casket, like at Royal Rumble 94? Did Undertaker cut that promo inside the casket live, or was it pre-taped? Also, at In Your House, when Mankind appeared in the casket during the Undertaker Goldust match, Undertaker appearing in the casket at Mind Games during the Shawn Michaels Mankind match, and Undertaker escaping before Kane set the casket on fire at the Royal Rumble in 98. How was this done? The Royal Rumble deal, I just had always assumed it was pre-taped. Obviously, there wasn't a frickin', you know, I guess there could have been. I mean, who am I to say that it was impossible? But I'm pretty sure that was pre-taped. And if you remember, what happened was, so after all the heels put the Undertaker in the casket, and they're wheeling it down the aisle, the smoke starts to emit from the casket, and then you see Undertaker laying in the casket up on the video wall, and he's saying, you know, I will never rest in peace, and then he kind of dies. And then you have the Undertaker, or what we're supposed to believe is the Undertaker, being lifted up into the air over where the Titan, like the old little, I call it Titantron, but the little video screen, he's kind of being elevated into the air. I had always heard that that was Marty Jannetty dressed up as the Undertaker. I don't know if that's true. But I know it wasn't Undertaker. But as far as all the other tricks, you know, you mentioned all the other spots that you mentioned where somebody pops out of the casket, and how did they do that? Because, you know, during the match, they open the lid and nobody's in there. And then later on, they open the lid and out pops somebody. How do they do that? There's a trap door. It's a trap door in the casket. I think it's on the side of the casket. And when the casket is moved up against the edge of the ring, you know, there's somebody under the ring, and they get into the casket. That's how it works. So go back and watch any of those things, and especially you mentioned the Rumble in 98 when they set the casket on fire. If you pay attention, Kane chokeslams Undertaker into the casket. Undertaker loses the match. And then Kane and Paul Bearer, I think, are locking the casket, or they're hammering, whatever they're doing. The casket is still up against the side of the ring for a long time. I think Paul Bearer is like kind of looking on the side to see, you know, waiting for his cue that, okay, it's safe, he's not in there, let's wheel it up the aisle. So that's it. That's the big secret, which isn't really much of one, but there's a trap door in the casket, and now I've ruined wrestling for your young mind. I feel terrible. No, I feel great. I feel fine. Vinny from New Jersey, I decided to watch Royal Rumble 1993 recently, and it got me thinking, what if Ric Flair and Vince McMahon had found some common ground on how Rick was going to be used, and Flair decided to stay? instead of going back to WCW. At the time in WWF, what if they decided to launch their own version of the Four Horsemen? Who do you think would have been in the group? You have Ric Flair leading, and I think the obvious choice for the J.J. Dillon manager role would be Bobby Heenan, but who do you think could have played the Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and Barry Windham roles? 1993 WWF. You know, I can't, just can't picture the Horsemen there with that roster at the time. It just doesn't work. It really doesn't work, but... you're right, though. I would absolutely have Bobby Heenan in the manager's role. Heenan had already retired from managing by that point because of his neck. So let's say Heenan couldn't do it. Bobby, maybe he wants to, but he can't. He's done. He's retired. He's not managing anymore. You could have J.J. Dillon himself. J.J. Dillon was working behind the scenes for WWE at that time when Flair was in the company. So he could have conceivably been talked into doing it himself. So we have Heenan, and if not Heenan, we have J.J. Dillon himself. Mr. Perfect would have to be part of that group. I know he had just done the split with Flair, but I'd have come up with a way to reunite them somehow. Maybe Flair makes the pitch and smooths things over and convinces him to join the group. But Kurt Hennig has to be in there. He fits. He's the closest thing to a horseman, probably, other than Flair, that they had at the time. He would have to be. And the chemistry with him and Flair was always fun, so I would want him in that group. And he was always better as a heel anyway. I'm trying to go over the 1993 roster in my head. I'm a big fan, actually, of WWF in that period, 92, 93. I know business was just the fucking shits, but, you know, I grew up on that. I love that whole period. I'm just trying to go over the roster in my head. I can't picture hardly any of these other guys being in the Horsemen, but I'll tell you what. You know who I think would go in the group to round out, who I think would make sense? Ted DiBiase and IRS. I know IRS was a goofy gimmick, but Money Inc. could work as part of the Horsemen. Especially DiBiase. You know, Mr. Moneybags driving around in stretch limos, throwing money around, wearing suits. He could absolutely fit in the Horsemen. And it could have helped revitalize his own career in WWE, which was already on the downswing. You know, he was nearing the end of his career there. I think he also had neck issues. But if they went back a little bit to what made the Million Dollar Man character work so well in the 80s, you know, if they brought a little bit of that back, yeah, I think that could work. I thought about maybe instead of Money Inc., the Steiners, you turn them heel and put the Steiner brothers in there. But, you know, I think they just would have worked better as a babyface team going after the Horsemen, going after DiBiase and IRS like they did at that time. So, Ric Flair, Mr. Perfect, Ted DiBiase, and IRS as the Four Horsemen. With Bobby Heenan as their manager, and if not Bobby, J.J. Dillon. That, to me, probably would have been the best version of the Horsemen you could do, just based on who they had on that roster in 93. You know, Razor Ramon probably could have worked too, now that I think about it. I could see that. And Flair already had the alliance with Razor. When Razor first came in, it was so weird because Razor came in and he was pushed as a main eventer almost instantly. He had more of a main event push in the first 6 months of his career than he did the remaining however many years he was in WWE. So they pushed him hard right out of the gate, and he had a little alliance going with Flair. In fact, he and Flair were tag team partners at the Survivor Series in 92. You know, they were going to wrestle Savage and Warrior before Warrior got shit canned, and so it turned out to be Savage and Perfect instead. And even just the character itself, I think Razor could have worked. So yeah, I think storyline wise that would have fit. Aaron from Philly. Buy or sell as an announcer, Gorilla Monsoon or Jim Ross? Jim Ross is the greatest play-by-play guy in the history of wrestling. So the answer is Jim Ross. And I'm a huge Gorilla Monsoon fan. I am one of the biggest Monsoon fans you will find. Him and Bobby Heenan together, all-time favorite announce team. Gorilla and Jesse Ventura may be my second favorite. But he needed somebody like that to play off of. With anyone else, it just wasn't the same when Monsoon was doing commentary. Yeah, he was charismatic. He could be funny. Yeah, he had a personality, which was funny because that was the opposite of his wrestling character that he played, you know, many years earlier. But no one sold the emotion of a match like Jim Ross. You know, there's a reason to this day when there's a major angle on TV. Like, take the brawl last month as an example, with Brock and Undertaker. In my head, I'm sitting there thinking, man, I wonder what this would sound like if Jim Ross was on commentary. And I find myself saying that a lot when there's a big match or a major angle. Man, how would the sound of JR was calling it? Like, JR in his prime. I'm not sitting there thinking, man, I wonder what this would be like if Gorilla Monsoon was calling it. And to me, that's the difference. So as much as I love Monsoon, I've got to buy on JR and sell on Gorilla. William from Calgary has a buy or sell. It's a little tougher. Which of the following had the biggest championship run in the history of WWE? Would it be Bruno Sammartino holding the title from 1963 till 1971, where he sold out Madison Square Garden more times than any superstar in history, or Hulk Hogan during the Hulkamania era from 84 on, when he sold more merchandise, pay-per-views, etc.? Buy or sell on which of the two had the biggest impact in wrestling, Sammartino or Hogan? Well, it's almost two different questions that you're asking. You know, who had the biggest championship run is different than who had the biggest impact in all of wrestling. Of the two, if we're talking impact, there is no question that would be Hogan. That could be good impact, that could be bad impact, that could be TNA impact, depending on what we're talking about here, but it would absolutely be Hulk Hogan no matter what. Even if we don't count the last 20 years of Hogan's career, if we just go by that first decade of Hulkamania, the impact that he had on WWE going national and on WCW when he first came in, not even counting the NWO stuff, he makes the cut as being, you know, more impactful by far. On who had the bigger championship run, you know, Bruno's was the longest, no doubt about that. The guy was this cultural icon to a lot of people in the Northeast. But I think that's the key. You know, we're talking about the Northeast. You mentioned all the MSG sellouts with Hogan. It went far beyond MSG. You know, it went to Chicago and it went to Los Angeles and it went to Boston. It went all over the country, even the world. You know, the UK. Hogan only held the title for 4 years. Only 4 years. Sounds silly. I can't even fathom somebody holding the title for 2 years now, let alone four. But those 4 years that he was champion from 84 to 88 were so important to the growth and to the expansion of the WWF. And you're right. You know, there was also merchandise. There was pay-per-view. There was WrestleMania. And Hogan was a huge part of WrestleMania becoming as big as it did. Hulk Hogan put WrestleMania on the map. I mean, that guy wrestled in 8 of the first 9 WrestleMania main events. There was never any of that when Bruno was champion. You didn't have Bruno t-shirts and Bruno plush teddy bears. You didn't have pay-per-view. You didn't have WrestleMania. So as important as Bruno was to Vince Sr., he was their top guy. He was probably more respected than Hogan was to a lot of the older fans, you know, as an old school wrestler. I would argue that Hogan's title run was bigger. You know, I mean, it's a business, right? We talk about the wrestling business. That's what it is. Hogan was bigger business. He was on all the talk shows. He was doing media. Everybody knew who Hulk Hogan was. A lot of the older fans knew full well, you know, who Bruno Sammartino was, but he didn't have the same kind of name recognition that Hogan had. And by the way, you talk about impact. I never hear about guys who say, man, you know, I became a fan because of Bruno Sammartino, the way they would say that about Hulk Hogan or Ric Flair or Shawn Michaels. I probably wouldn't be a wrestling fan right now were it not for Hulk Hogan back in the 80s. There are a lot of people listening to this right now who would say the exact same thing. That's real impact, because most of the people who would have said that about Bruno Sammartino, they're not watching anymore. They're not around anymore. But to this day, a lot of the older fans who are still around, not all of them, but a good number of them, they started watching because of Hulk Hogan and Hulkamania and the matches with Andre and Orndorff and Savage and Warrior. You don't have to like Hogan. You know, people think I don't like Hogan. I never said that. I don't know where people are getting that from. Why? Because I speak my mind? Because I'm not nice in everything I have to say? When Hogan says and does stupid shit, I talk about it. I call him out on it. I hate this notion that because you have these people who are these legends, these legendary figures, they could do no wrong. How can you say something bad about them? The impact they had on you as a kid, it was 20 fucking years ago, 30 fucking years ago. What does that have to do with today? I think it's more sad than anything else to see where Hogan is at in his life. You know, Hogan and Flair should be at just a level above everybody else. They should be respected. They should be, you know, living the life. And then you hear about all these problems, these money problems and the divorces and lawsuits and then stupid shit that Hogan says and all the lies and the bullshit. It's sad. I don't hate Hulk Hogan. I don't like some of the things he's done. There's a lot about the guy that I just shake my head at. But I don't hate him. I wouldn't be a fan if it wasn't for the guy. But you don't have to like Hulk Hogan or think he's a great wrestler to give him, you know, give him his props and admit that, yeah, he probably had the biggest impact in wrestling. So I'm buying on Hogan and I'm selling on Bruno. And we end with this week's sad tweet, which comes from @HeathSlaterOMRB, one man rock band. Someone tweeted him asking where they can buy his shirt. And in response, Slater said, well, if at WWE Shop would make some, you can get them there. But they don't have time for me, I guess. He had posted a semi-cryptic tweet the night before about having to know when it's over, that you've done the best you could do. He sounds depressed. I hope he's doing okay. You know, because if he's frustrated, I could totally understand why. I mean, put yourself in his position. He's been there for how many years now? And they have him slotted at a certain level, in a certain spot. He's kind of, you know, pigeonholed in there. And it's hard to break out of that when you've been doing the same thing for so long. But I'm sure he's not the only one in WWE who feels that way. I'm sure there's a lot of very frustrated people who are unhappy with how they're being used and what they're doing with them, if they're doing anything with them at all. He's far from the only one. But, yeah, they probably should come up with something for him to do. I remember when he was working with all the legends. Remember they were heading into Raw 1000? And week after week, he was working matches with Sid and Vader. I think he even worked a match with Lita, or Lita did a moonsault on him once. And I remember reading that all the legends had nothing but great things to say about Heath Slater. They were all very complimentary. They were impressed by him. They loved working with him. You can go back to when they did the Nexus storyline in 2010. This was 5 years ago. When he was part of the Nexus and they brought Bret Hart in, and Bret Hart was actually getting physical and he was wrestling, Bret Hart would, I mean, 99.9% of the time, the person that he was working spots with was Heath Slater. I mean, you go back and watch that big brawl they had on the go-home show to SummerSlam or the 10-man tag at SummerSlam, you go and watch who Bret Hart worked with. Who was the first guy that Bret Hart flocked to and was punching and kind of working with? It was Heath Slater. And I think that tells you they have, you know, a certain level of trust in him. But again, he's been in that comedy jobber role for so long, and he was part of 3MB, and his buddies got fired. They kept Slater. They obviously saw something in him. Otherwise, they could have gotten rid of all three. They got rid of Galloway, which was a joke. Talk about a wasted talent. And look at what Galloway has done since leaving WWE. I don't know. I mean, maybe the best thing for Slater is to go away. Go away and start working at a few different places and really build his name back up and get back some of that respect maybe that people have lost for him, because it's not like the booking in WWE is doing him any favors. And you could say, well, there's always room for a comedy guy. You know, Santino made a great career out of it. And maybe Heath Slater can be that guy. Yeah, maybe, but I don't see them doing that with him. So, you know, if he is legitimately frustrated, I can totally understand it. But it's sad to, you feel bad for the guy. Anyway, if you have a sad tweet suggestion, you can email them to me, or you can tweet me, @Solomonster, and maybe I'll use it on the show and give you credit for it. And don't forget, the first 10 episodes ever of this podcast, recorded way back when in 07 and 08, are now up for your listening pleasure on our YouTube channel, along with all the other Sound Off extras and pay-per-view reviews. There's book reviews, there's DVD reviews, there's interviews. You can go back and listen to my interview with JTG, my interview with Matthew of Botchamania, George Napolitano, probably the greatest wrestling photographer of all time. He shared some great stories when I interviewed him a few years ago. He's been all over the place. I mean, he's friendly with the biggest names in the history of the business. He was in, I think it was Puerto Rico, when Ric Flair dropped the championship to Jack Veneno. He was down there with Flair, and it was crazy. It was almost like a riot-like atmosphere. He was ringside for the Montreal Screwjob when Bret spit in Vince's face, or spat, I should say, in Vince's face. So there's a lot of fun stuff up on the YouTube channel. If you've never been there, hit the subscribe button. When new content goes up, which periodically will happen, you will be alerted. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. You could also friend me on Facebook. We have a Facebook fan page that you can like. We have a private discussion group. You can apply for membership to that. We're all over the place on social media. And I just want to say, before we wrap up here, one last time, a sincere thank you to everybody who has helped get this podcast to 400 episodes. Without an audience, you know, there's no reason to keep doing a show. And the audience has grown. It is built bigger now than it's ever been. 400 episodes is a lot. It really is. I don't know that I ever had any expectation of what number of shows I would do when I first started doing it. I don't even think I thought about it. And just to think it's been 400 and now we kind of work our way to 500 is kind of crazy, to be perfectly honest with you. But people obviously like what they hear. I think that's just awesome, and hope that you will listen for 400 more and keep spreading the word. And that's really the best way you can support the show, more than any kind of donation or t-shirt or anything like that, is just to tell people about the show and try to convert them into fans, right? And spread the word. And when this goes up, I'll put links on Twitter and Facebook. Retweet that, share it on Facebook, you know, the 400th episode, and make people aware of the show. Of course, you can support the show with a PayPal donation. You can use our Audible link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. It takes 2 seconds. You sign up. Costs you nothing unless you want to extend it beyond the 30 days, but you get a free audiobook. And, of course, you can buy a t-shirt on ProWrestlingTees.com. We have over 20 of those to choose from, with more going up in the future. So the Sound Off continues to grow and to get bigger and better, and we've got more fun things planned for the future. So, again, thank you very much for listening. We will be back with our Night of Champions predictions next weekend on 401. The train rolls on. Oh, God. I'm using that fucking rolls on analogy now. Maybe I can edit that out. Anyway, we'll see you right back here next weekend for more of the Sound Off. Until then, be well, stay safe. We'll see you next week.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
If WWE were a person, how would you describe them? It's just a very bizarre question. But these are the different options they gave as passionate, talented, funny, modest, except for all those did-you-know facts they pepper us with every single week. Kind, cheerful, sweet, surprising, adventurous, flexible. How the fuck can an organization be flexible? This is a real survey question here. You would think you were going on a date. I have no interest in dating WWE. They're clingy, they're painfully unfunny, and all they do is talk about themselves. They're not my type.
The Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.